Hi, you're watching DNA Today, a multi-award-winning genetics podcast where we explore everything to do with genetics, from CRISPR to rare diseases to new research. We have won the Science in Medicine Podcast Award for many years now. We have hundreds of episodes, and we really hope you enjoy these conversations where we dive into so many genetic concepts. I'm Kira Deneen, a certified genetic counselor and your host.
Brian Merlino was born with Pierre-Robin syndrome. PRS, as we will call it, is a rare congenital birth defect that affects the craniofacial development. Navigating life as a patient from a young age sparked a passion for science, medicine, advocacy, and ultimately inspired her to pursue a career in genetic counseling.
Corinne currently works as a clinical research coordinator for the Palliative and Advanced Illness Research, or PAIR, Center at the University of Pennsylvania. There, she supports multiple studies focused on improving the effectiveness and efficiency of specialty palliative care services for seriously ill patients. With our co-producer, Kira Deneen, Corinne also serves as communications lead for the DNA Today podcast for over 3 years. Kira is joining us today as a guest host for this conversation. In 2020, Corinne received her BS in biology and healthcare ethics from St. Joseph's University. Now, Corinne will be a graduate student in genetic counseling at the University of Pennsylvania.
Welcome, Corinne. It's a pleasure to have you on It Happened to Me Today. So let's start with the basics. What is Pierre-Robin syndrome?
So you touched on this a little bit, Beth, but it's a congenital birth defect, which means it's present at birth, and it's characterized by micrognathia or a small lower jaw. I apologize in advance. I'm going to talk with my hands a lot today. micrognathia, which is a small lower jaw, glossoptosis, which is displacement of the tongue, and ultimately a cleft palate, which was one of the most major phenotypic presentations that I suffered from. And I should also note that Pierre-Robin syndrome can also be called Pierre-Robin sequence because of the nature of the disease. So it's called a sequence because the condition is caused by a chain of events that occur in the oral cavity during embryonic development. So the lower jaw forms to be too small, which results in the displacement of the tongue, which ultimately causes the cleft palate because the tongue prevents the palate from forming completely. So that's what ultimately causes the main symptom.
So you're saying the cause occurs in the mouth. What are the repercussions of that?
Yeah, so most children that are born with Pierre-Robin syndrome often experience feeding difficulties. That's one of the main concerns, because without the palate, if you're fed normally, like a parent would breastfeed or bottle feed a baby, without the palate, the food goes right up the nose and there's a lot of risk for choking. So babies born with PRS typically require specialized feeding bottles or a feeding tube if they're not able to get enough nutrition via bottle feeding. Some children have breathing difficulties, depending on the extent of the craniofacial symptoms. Children can have hearing issues and issues with speech and development in those areas.
So Corinne, how did your parents feed you?
I forget the name, but there was a special bottle that basically like prevented air from going in through, and it was a special bottle top, and they would have to feed me upright. That way the food could actually go down my throat instead of up my nose.
Okay. Did that take a long time to do that feeding?
Yeah, a very long time. Feedings were a really stressful time for my mom, so I'm told. It caused a lot of distress for me, which caused a lot of distress for her and my dad. And they were the only people that could feed me, because it was kind of hard to explain now, to someone else how to use a bottle that no one's ever seen.
Is there any difference between the cleft palate that comes with the PRS and cleft palate that other children are just born with.
Yeah, the only difference would be the cause of the cleft palate. So it could either be due to environmental conditions. So cleft palates are actually really common in twins because there's a lot of crowding in the womb. So if you're not able to, this is not a scientific term, but like unfold properly during embryonic development, and the tongue is displaced, that can prevent the palate from forming, or there are genetic causes that alter the sequence of embryonic development that result in a cleft palate.
So, Corinne, is this considered to be a genetic condition?
Yeah, so kind of like I just said, so Pierre Robin syndrome can be either isolated, which is what I have, meaning it occurs on its own, or it can be part of other conditions. Stickler syndrome is one of them that affects bones beyond the craniofacial skeleton. I have isolated Pierre Robin syndrome, and in isolated cases, the gene that's typically implicated is the SOX9 gene, or areas in and around that. And the SOX9 gene encodes a protein that plays a really important role in skeletal development in the embryo. So it happens really early on in embryonic development, this whole chain of events.
And then, Corinne, for your parents, you're the first child in the family. And so when they were going through with your pregnancy, I mean, at what point did they figure out that you might have something different with cleft palate? At what point were they figuring out, oh, it's Pierre Robin? Do you know the timeline? Because obviously, like, you don't remember because you were in utero or just being born.
Yeah, so they didn't find out my mom had a normal, healthy pregnancy. She had done non-invasive prenatal screening for chromosomal anomalies, and that all came back clear. Ultrasounds were normal. And it wasn't until I was born. She had a healthy pregnancy up until right around like the week that I was due. I came a little bit early, but I was breached, and they ended up having to perform a C-section. So wasn't a vaginal birth. And it wasn't until I was born that they knew that I had a cleft palate. And then I think a few weeks later, they met with a genetics team at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. I was transferred from where I'd been born to a specialized hospital. And then a few weeks, I think, after I was born, it was officially labeled as Pierre Robin syndrome. But they knew the day that I was born that I had a cleft palate. They whisked me away. My parents had no clue what was happening. So, yeah, they had no notice. And I was the first child. So they were just kind of nervous anyway to be parents. And then throwing this all in the loop, a baby that can't feed normally and may have breathing issues and a whole lifetime of complications. It was definitely stressful and scary for them. But I think they handled it as well as they could have.
Clearly they did. Clearly.
Yeah. I think it's tough because ultrasound, we can see a lot, but we can't see everything. And we're also talking about, you know, 25-ish years ago. Yes. So that's something else to keep in mind that, you know, it's not like Corinne was born yesterday.
Yeah.
So that's an aspect that, like, you know, cleft lip, that's much easier to see with ultrasound, but cleft palate, it's harder because you're, you know, if you guys are watching this video, you're looking inside the mouth there. And so you've got a lot crowding it. Whereas lips, you can kind of just look right away that, you know, 3D ultrasound and looking at it that way. So with your experience and, you know, really your parents' experience of your diagnostic odyssey, it was relatively short. I mean, you can look at a baby and see a cleft palate and then kind of be figuring out, okay, well, what led to that? And what else should we consider? Like you mentioned, you know, like at the time they might've been like, oh, do you have a not an isolated case where there's other things we need to be concerned about. Is this a typical timeline, or were you late to be diagnosed, early, at least for people 25 years ago? Like, I don't know, maybe it's changed since.
Yeah, I think for people 25 years ago, it seems pretty on brand, and it was pretty easy then when I was born for them to look at the phenotypic presentation of what I was born with and decide that it was Pierre Robin syndrome versus Stickler syndrome or other conditions where a cleft palate is present, just because of, again, the small jaw, the displaced tongue, and knowing what the course of treatment would be from there. But I think now it's a little bit different, especially with more invasive prenatal screening, and you can figure out, oh, if you're going to have a baby that's born with Stickler syndrome, you can kind of plan for these things. But like you said, even on ultrasound now, it's really hard to see. It's easy to see a cleft lip, but it's not easy to see a cleft palate. But the only difference is, so when I was first born, I think we'll get into this a little bit later, but I had to wait 10 months before I had surgery. And now I think they're doing surgeries much sooner. So I think the treatment, the course of like diagnosis and treatment has changed a little bit, but from what I know, it's not so different. You kind of really can't officially know until after birth, because there's not like a concrete genetic test for Pierre-Robin syndrome.
Now, what kind of doctor and what kind of specialist would be able to identify that the cleft palate was Pierre-Robin? And how would you, know when to bring these doctors into the process?
Yeah, so we're really lucky. I grew up and was born right outside of Philadelphia. So we have easy access to the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, and they actually have a specialized cleft lip and palate program under their overall craniofacial program. And Pierre-Robin syndrome is one of the conditions that they see. And it's about 25 minutes from my house. So once I was born and we knew that there were some things going on, my parents met with the genetics team at CHOP, and that's how they were able to confirm that it was PRS and not something else. And then I was lucky. So part of the cleft lip and palate program, you see an audiologist to monitor your hearing, and I had some hearing issues early on in life. You see a speech pathologist, you see just a general pediatrician. I have a plastic surgeon who I say it's two different ones. I started with one, he retired, and then I saw a separate plastic surgeon for my later surgeries.
Friend, did you have speech issues?
Not anything severe, like typical like TH or F for TH substitution, like I have to brush my teeth, like kind of normal things that kids do. They were actually really shocked that I didn't have more significant speech issues. And throughout my development, like I said, I was monitored by a team of like 8+ specialists for kind of the first 18 years of my life. Would see every doctor at least once a year, if not more in between. And the only thing related to my speech is that because my palate is short, I had a palate repair that used tissue from my throat to repair it so that food wouldn't go up my nose anymore. But then as I hit puberty, my adenoid pads, which are like on the back of your throat, I relied apparently very heavily on my adenoid pads to make contact with my palate when I speak and talk and laugh and eat and things. So when you hit puberty, your adenoid pads shrink. So after I was about like 13, I have a lot of air escape, especially when I'm speaking quickly or in eating. Sometimes I get food that goes up my nose or doesn't go down the right pipe. So other than air escape, like hypernasality when I speak, I luckily don't have any major speech issues. After the first few years of my life, the hearing issues subsided. I'd had tubes put in to help drain the fluid, but I suffered from chronic ear infections for the first few years of my life. But yeah, other than that, I'm very lucky that it wasn't more severe.
And what were some of the surgeries? Because I know you've had multiple, you know, throughout your childhood. Did you have any in adulthood, or it was more like before 18?
Yeah. So my first one, I said they waited until I was 10 months old to allow the tissue in my throat to expand to kind of repair the gap in my palate, and then had tubes put in my ears to drain fluid when I was like a toddler. And then I was really lucky. I went quite a few years without surgery. It was kind of a wait and see. Every year I would go back in July and they'd say, okay, nothing actionable right now. We'll wait and see till next year. And then wait and see became, okay, we need to do something. So because my lower jaw was really underdeveloped, actually suffered from an underbite. And so when you have an underbite, they can do one of two things. They can bring your lower jaw backwards, or they can bring your upper jaw forward. And one of the presentations of Pierre-Robin syndrome is a really flat face and delayed midfacial development. So when I was a freshman in high school, I was like 14, 15. I had a Lafort osteotomy 1, which is where they take the bones, kind of just your upper jaw bone below the nose, and bring it forward to then kind of bring the middle of my face forward and help alleviate the underbite that I had.
Oh my goodness.
Wow.
Yeah. That must have been major It's major surgery.
Yeah, my jaw was wired shut for
Oh,
6 weeks.
no.
Had to eat liquids for a while.
Oh, goodness.
I had the surgery in May, so I had finished the remainder of my freshman year of high school from home because of the recovery timing. I was really active in sports and stuff growing up, so in order to be recovered in time for
The next
my
year.
sports seasons and hope to play and not miss anything, and also to allow time. Part of it was I had to have braces on my top and bottom teeth so that they could wire my jaw shut, and there was a lot of like pre-orthodontic work that went in. So it was kind of a balancing act between, okay, the teeth are ready, and also like we're doing this as early as we can so that you have time to recover. And so they move the upper jaw forward, they break the jaw, move it forward, and then they secure it with titanium plates and screws. And then recovery, it takes more than 6 months for the swelling to go down.
Oh my goodness.
So at the time, I think I didn't look that weird, but now I look back at pictures and like, oh my gosh, like I thought I looked like great, was like 100% recovered, and it's like 6 months later, I'm like, I can't believe I was walking around like that.
Wow, well, you
Um,
look
but then
beautiful now, I gotta say. It's
thank
worth
you.
it. But how did you cope? I mean, you're in high school. That's a time where you want to be out and about, and you had to live within your home for 6 months.
Six weeks.
I mean, six weeks, but then 6 months recovery, was it?
6 months, like I really didn't look like myself. Swelling, especially in the face, takes a while to go down.
Oh my goodness.
No, it's definitely interesting. I mean, I feel very blessed. Like, although I've had this experience, I feel very blessed that it hasn't impacted every aspect of my life, and I look relatively, I don't want to use the word normal, but
You
you
look
would look at me and not
beautiful.
know that I've been
I was
through
going to say,
something.
you're a little bit more than normal. You're gorgeous. I never would have known when I met you that this was your background. I mean, you
But
had
no
said that
one,
when we first met, but
yeah,
it's.
but no one does. And so it's this weird thing where I kind of balance, like, this is a huge part of my identity. It's something crazy that I've gone through, that my family has gone through, and I still experience some kind of side effects from the surgeries and just the condition in general. But I feel kind of lucky that I am able to kind of go about my life and kind of forget about it sometimes. Reflecting on it for this has been interesting, and reflecting on it, I talked about it in my personal statement for graduate school. Coping was definitely, I think, being able to just kind of rely on my friends and my family, and know that there was a and feeling grateful. I mean, there are kids that have six surgeries a year or
Oh
more
my.
for their entire lives, and it's very apparent that they have a craniofacial condition. So I kind of balance this like feeling lucky and feeling guilty, like knowing that it could be worse, and feeling lucky that it's not.
Well, you were the firstborn in your family, correct? And I'm
Yes.
wondering, were your parents, do you have siblings?
I do. I have twin brothers who are about 2 years, 2.5 years younger than me.
Well, were your parents worried about having another child with Pierre Robin? What were the risk factors? What are the risk factors?
So, when my mom was pregnant with my brothers, they obviously didn't know they were twins at first. But when they had gone through genetic testing, obviously I had received genetic testing as a baby, but they also tested my parents to see if it was something that they passed on, or we learned that it was de novo and something that just happened in me that wasn't from them. And so when they did that, they realized that their risk of having another child with Pierre-Robin syndrome, or even a cleft palate in general, was no more than population level risk.
Now, 20 to 40% of cases of PRS are isolated, as you mentioned, yours is, meaning there are no other symptoms. But what about the other cases? Can Pierre Robin be part of a larger syndrome? You had mentioned.
Yeah, I think I mentioned Stickler syndrome. That's the one that stands out. Like I said, they share kind of similar causes. They both affect the skeleton. It's just a matter of where. Pierre Robin syndrome is concentrated in the oral cavity, and Stickler syndrome kind of expands and affects the ears and other areas of the body. I believe they have some cardiac issues as well. And so it's actually interesting when Pierre Robin syndrome is isolated, it's typically de novo or a new mutation. But when it's inherited with something like Stickler syndrome, I think it actually follows the inheritance pattern of the condition that that it coincides with.
Gotcha.
Yeah, I want to say Stickler syndrome is autosomal recessive. I should probably look that up while you were talking. but so because of that, your mom, when she was pregnant with your twin brothers, she didn't have any extra screenings. I'm sure that they were just, you know, normal ultrasounds. But mm-hmm. at that point, it was more like, oh, now this is a twin pregnancy. So it's high risk for those reasons, like all twin pregnancies are.
Yeah, they had done, again, the like typical trisomy 18, 13, 18 and 21. But she didn't undergo because they had undergone genetic testing when they were trying to figure out what I had. They didn't receive any additional screening or testing. And you're right, the pregnancy was monitored more closely because it was a twin higher risk pregnancy.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, you know, if you and your partner decide to have biological children, is there a chance that you could pass this on to a child? Like you said, mm-hmm. it's a random mutation in you that has led to Pierre-Robin and this, the sequence we've been talking about with the small jaw, and then your tongue is really pushing up into your palate. So that's not forming correctly. So it's, you know, this sequences we've been talking about. So is there a risk if you have biological children?
Yeah. When I saw this question on this sheet, actually, it's not something that I've really thought about a lot just because I'm obviously of a reproductive age, but I'm not really thinking with that lens yet, but it's a good reminder. I'm pretty sure, like, the few times that I have looked into it, because it's a de novo mutation, I think there's like maybe a 3-5 chance. Kira, you've gone through graduate school, so you might be able to know this a little bit more than I can, but I think de novo mutations can be passed on, but it's a really low percentage. So that's obviously something that I'll be thinking about, and definitely I'll pursue testing when I'm kind of in that headspace and I'm ready to have kids, because it's definitely
something. Yeah, we could book a session.
Yeah, Kira, you have to stay in prenatal until I have kids.
Yeah, exactly.
Or if I work in prenatal myself, I'll just...
Right, then you can take a mirror and, you know, do a nice session. Yeah. Yeah, and I take it back. Stickler syndrome is autosomal dominant, so it's not recessive. That way we don't have listeners emailing in saying, Kira's wrong again. And one cool thing that I think has come out of this for you is your experience of volunteering as a peer supporter for Philly Faces, which is just like the coolest name. And you guys spell Faces PH to match with Philly.
Yes.
Can you share about this organization, what it provides patients, and how your role has evolved over the years? Because I imagine you started as one of the kiddos in it, and now it's on the flip side.
Yeah, so this was years ago, really, that Philly Faces started. It's a nonprofit organization that's kind of funneled through the craniofacial program at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. And it's a nonprofit that's just really focused on supporting kids with craniofacial anomalies and their families. They host a wide variety of events to get kids with craniofacial anomalies together in a room where everyone looks like them. And some of my favorite events, and ironically, this was happening when I was having my craniofacial surgeries. There was a dog named Lentilbean, who was from the Philadelphia area. And he and his mom, Lindsay, would actually attend an event called the Best Friends Bash. And it was a co-hosted event between the CHOP Craniofacial Program, Philly Faces, and Penn Veterinary Medicine. Penn has a huge, very specialized veterinary surgery center. So taking dogs with craniofacial conditions, cleft lips, cleft palates, other craniofacial anomalies, cancers of the face, and then bringing them to this event with kiddos to allow kids to see a dog that looks like them and make them understand that, oh, a dog just had the same surgery that I did, and like, how cool is that? So that was one of my favorite events, just seeing people come together and seeing how involved the families are. And I know it means a lot to kids with craniofacial conditions to see other people that look like them and just kind of feel like everyone in the room looks like them, which is something that doesn't happen often. We would also go into schools and using the book Wonder, which yes. I feel like a lot of people know about now. There's also a movie with Jennifer Gardner, using the book Wonder as a tool, and talking to kids and going in with other patients and their parents and talking to kids in elementary schools about choosing kind and knowing that people are more than what they look like on the outside. So I've had a lot of wonderful opportunities to volunteer and advocate for other kids with craniofacial conditions. And it's a great organization.
Yeah, no, it definitely sounds like it. And I'm curious, are you still being followed up at all, or do most people age out when they get to, early adulthood like you're in now? Or I don't know.
Yeah.
Is your 20s still early adulthood? Like I consider myself, and I'm only like 2 years older than you, so.
Yes, for the purposes of today's talk, 25 is early adulthood.
Yes, perfect.
And so is 27, 28.
Nice.
Yeah, so typically kids can be followed at CHOP. It used to be 18, now it's 21 for certain conditions. Some people kind of push the boundaries on that. I was technically, I like to say, kicked out when I was about 18. I had had another surgery after the LaForte osteotomy when I was like 15, because my body started to reject the titanium plates and screws that were in
Oh
my face. And it caused a lot of pain, really anytime I
no. Oh,
had
you're fortunate.
congestion, which is kind of often. So I actually had a second, like a reversal of the first surgery to remove the plates and screws. So I would say like 6 months to a year after that, that was when I was about 17. So I would say 18. I was kind of done receiving care at CHOP. And I still now that I work at Penn, which shares a campus with CHOP, I actually just got coffee with my plastic surgeon, Dr. Taylor, a few
Oh.
weeks ago. And now it's cool because I'll get to work and go through clinical rotations at Penn and work in a clinic that my parents probably went to and interact with all of these people that I've known as a patient over the years. And now I'll get to be a student and then hopefully a colleague, which is just so cool and so full circle. And I'm so
It's
excited.
so full circle. I just
Yeah.
remember so many conversations as you were applying to schools and us having these talks of like, wouldn't it be great if you match with Penn? And like, here we are.
Oh,
Yeah, and
well,
it
that's
was
so
really
wonderful.
helpful as I was, yeah, once I knew that I wanted to be a genetic counselor, I had the in of the patient family liaison for the craniofacial program. When I told her that I was interested, she was able to set me up with the person who coordinates all of the shadowing for genetic counselors at CHOP. And I'm sure Kira knows shadowing genetic counselors is a really kind of hard experience to come by, especially now with like post-COVID hospital restrictions. So I was really lucky to be able to shadow like multiple genetic counselors, and now it's cool. A lot of the people that I shadowed will now be my teachers in my program, so I'm really
That's
excited.
tiny field.
Yeah,
Exciting.
so I'm learning.
Corinne, congratulations.
Thank
Congratulations
you.
on being accepted as a student at Penn. And lucky for us, I think that you have chosen genetic counseling. You obviously are passionate about it. And I have to assume, am I taking a leap, that having PRS led you to this career choice?
That would be a very safe assumption.
Yeah.
I talked about it in my personal statement and a lot in my interviews with programs, but it really gave I knew for a very long time that I wanted to do something clinically with patients and ideally work in pediatrics. It taught me the value of autonomy. If I look through my chart from when I was a patient, I think a lot of the notes say like patient and her parents, or the patient and her mom, who was usually at my visits with me. I was involved in all of these conversations. They had proposed for me to have other surgeries. They wanted to put an extension on my palate again because of the air escape and hypernasality, and I was really nervous that it would affect the way that I speak, and I would kind of have to like relearn how to talk with this extra skin in my throat. And so I was like, if it's not medically necessary, then it's not something that I want to do. I was like 15 at the time, and they totally respected and supported that decision. So it really taught me the value of autonomy, and I always felt like my team was speaking not just to my parents but also to me even as a kid. So I think it really being involved in those conversations really gave me an appreciation for autonomy and receiving specialized care. I realized how lucky I am that we are so close to CHOP. People come from all over the world to receive care there, and the fact that we're 25 minutes away and I could receive,
Yeah.
yeah, such specialized care and be followed so closely, and the fact that I can walk by my surgeon on the sidewalk and I haven't been a patient of his in years and he would still know who I am and come up and give me a hug. It's just like such a cool
No,
thing.
that's
So yeah, I
Corinne.
think I've always been interested in science, but the patient care aspect of it really influenced my decision.
Corinne, you have talked about now multiple surgeries, and some of the surgeries didn't go quite the way doctors had expected or you would have wanted. How did you cope throughout your childhood with these multiple surgeries? You're talking about making decisions, really being part of the team. This is a lot of responsibility for a young person. How'd you get through this?
Yeah, I mean, my parents are both so wonderful. They obviously took me to all of my appointments and were there for every surgery. And my mom spoon-fed me afterwards. And while I was hating my life because I was eating the same tomato soup every day, and then she was just a saint through it all. So definitely my parents, especially my mom. And like I said, I think being able to kind of like compartmentalize this part of my life and resuming relatively normal activities, like I think just knowing that it could have been a lot worse and being able to kind of like put this part of my life aside and kind of deal with it when I felt like dealing with it, and then being able to go about my normal activities, my sports, and being really interested in school. And I think channeling it into a career that I'm excited about, like I feel so lucky, even though this experience was obviously horrible at times, I feel so lucky that I've had this experience, because I don't think that I would have come to genetic counseling and just the fields of science and medicine and research and in general if I hadn't had this experience. So I think kind of framing it as like feeling lucky that I have this experience and get to do something that I'm so passionate about is like a good silver lining. Like I'll take the experience I had and if it's given me this, you know.
Corinne, you have the most positive outlook. I am listening to you, and you embody everything that we need in order to face adversity. It's exactly what Kathy and I talk about all the time, strategies for coping with a difficult situation. And you have answered every question. You're talking about being grateful to your parents, being grateful to your surgeons, being grateful to the team, being involved in school activities, and doing advocacy work. Is there anything I left out, that any other avenue that you have pursued that has helped you cope with this adversity?
I don't think so.
I mean, it's already a long list.
It's a very,
like,
that's very long.
I feel like I'm missing something.
You are an example to all of us.
When you write
us.
It all out like that, or say it all out like that, it's kind of a
this
lot.
As long as we thank the parents, that's the most important, right? So we've checked
it out.
Yeah,
I feel like you have to. You win an award. Like, I'd like to thank my family and then my friends.
Yes.
The Academy,
wait,
you know.
But Corinne, it's your positivity, though, the very essence of you, is to me what I hear that has helped you cope, that being a positive person and not a woe is me, not why is the world against me, but I am lucky. I heard you say that over and over. I am lucky. And the fact that you're going out and speaking to other people and talking about, I am lucky, I made it through and I can help others, I feel good about that. I am proud of you, Corinne, and I am proud to know you.
Thank you
so much for being a guest today.
Absolutely.
Of course. I want to touch on the luck. I think it's very easy for me to say I feel lucky again, because I can kind of compartmentalize this part of my life. There are many people that aren't able to walk around and not have the world know that they have something going on medically. So I think just acknowledging that is important. I feel lucky that I've been able to twist this into a positive experience. And I think just also, it's not like not that I would ever blame my parents if I did, but knowing that this was just a random thing that happened and it was out of everyone's control, I'd be wasting a lot of energy being angry at the world. Because it was really just a freak change that happened and obviously impacts my life very heavily, but I feel mostly grateful for the experience.
Thank you for giving us this lesson and teaching us what it takes to be a positive person.
It's been wonderful. I mean, thank you, Corinne, for being here today.
Thank you for having me.
We're just thrilled to have you. Your attitude and perspective, as Beth said, is inspirational. And the way you have tackled medical challenge in your life, with career and career choices and education and volunteerism and advocacy, is just wonderful to see and really something that's a gift to us all to just remind ourselves of what it's all about. And thank you. Great luck to you and your future as a genetic counselor. So many patients will be so lucky to have you. And as you said, yes, you had to go through what you went through to end up where you are. And just all wonderful, wonderful things and the best of luck. And thank you. Thank you for being here.
Yeah, thank you guys. It was awesome to be on today. And it's very full circle getting to record with Kira too. We've worked together for 3 years now. And I say the word podcast probably 35 times a week. So
definitely.
This is my first time on
That's
a podcast.
Yes. Well, you've been doing all the background
well, you were
work
terrific.
Like, for people listening.
Yeah.
You are a star yes. in the making, Corinne.
Yes. Thank well, thank you again.
Thanks for watching DNA Today. To access all of our episodes, head over to dnatoday.com. We also have a lot of bonus content on there that you can enjoy. If you have any questions, comments, suggestions, guest pitches, you name it, send them in to info@dnatoday.com. We'd also really appreciate if you could take a moment to rate and review the podcast on Apple, Spotify, wherever you listen to the show. It really helps more nerds like yourself find the show. Also, if you like giveaways and other ways to connect with us, I recommend following us on social. We're at DNA Today Podcast. We also have a Patreon if you want to be the most level involved in the show. That's also at DNA Today Podcast. Thank you so much for listening and watching. Join us next time to learn and discover new advances in the world of genetics.